Hi, I'm Bunny Guinness, and this is my podcast, Bunny in the Garden, with someone special. Someone who is well known for something other than their green fingers, but who is also a mustard-keen gardener. I'll discover them through their garden, why, how, and when they garden, the best tips they've learnt, and their gardening style and approach. The voice of my guest has been described as a bass, a baritone voice, a sonorous dark brown voice and more. Certainly, my guest this week has a voice that is highly distinctive, and his whole persona is too. You probably know him as Mr. Carson, the butler from Downton, who, surprisingly, is married to the late Queen Elizabeth II, Imelda Staunton, in The Crown. Jim Carter has starred in masses of films and TV shows, too numerous to mention, but his latest role is an abacus crunch in Wonka, the prequel to Charlie and the Chocolate Factory. He plays a depressed accountant alongside Timothée Chalamet, Hugh Grant, Rowan Atkinson, Olivia Colman, and scores of celebrities. It's lovely to have you on the podcast, Jim. I always knew that you and Imelda were keen gardeners. I see you at Presto at Chelsea on numerous occasions. But when I got here, my God, wow, straight away, I can tell you are mustard keen.
It's our main hobby, I think, and it's the main activity we enjoy doing together. You know, there's nothing better than a day in the garden, especially as we've got seats everywhere and we can sit down every 2 minutes and admire our handiwork. But no, it's a fantastic, you know, it gives us enormous pleasure because it's always changing, you know, I mean, with the seasons, but then, we're in the side garden, which faces south at the moment. This is going to be changed next year. We're going to put all our exotics in here, and then the tree at the front is growing too big, so that's shading everything, so we're going to have to put more ferns in there to cope with the shade. And it's ever evolving. If it was just maintaining a static garden, we'd be bored stiff.
Oh, no, the fun of it is doing it and building it on and dreams and things, yeah. Yeah. So when I sort of first read up about you and things, I mean, obviously everybody knows you as Carson from Downton, buttoned up, controlled. And then obviously you started your career off as magic maker in the circus cabaret. So I thought, I wonder whether the garden's going to be sort of exuberant fun or is it going to be buttoned up and tight? But how would you describe it?
I don't think it's a sort of a circus fun, but I think it's pretty exuberant. I mean, we go for colour. I'm a big fan of Christopher Lloyd's sort of successional planting. I mean, it's high maintenance. We're always, you know, when the dahlias are over, they come out there overwintered, the bulbs go in the early summer stuff, you know, lots of annuals and cosmos and zinnias and things, and with the dahlias coming back in later on. And so it's colourful. We colour, and I love the fact that you can put any colours together in the garden that you might not put together in an outfit, you know, but nothing clashes in the garden somehow. So
on this December day, you've got a lot of colour, a lot going on. And when I just went through your front gate off the road in North London, every square centimetre is packed with wonderful plants. Where some of your neighbours have block paviers and car parking, you have maximised it with the green stuff.
We have, yeah. I mean, we're lucky we've got sort of, because of the odd shape, we're on the curve in the street, so we've got a slightly bigger garden. I love gardening out here because you get to lean on your spade and chat to the neighbours a lot, you know. just when your back's starting to go, somebody says, oh, what's that called, you know. And look, Bunny, while we're here, can I do this? Can I ask you? This is in April, this is our big star, this tree peony here.
It's a white one.
With those massive, they're bigger than cabbages that they fly. Now, cutting back, I mean, I can see all this fresh stuff here. Can I go down into what looks like deadwood? Because it's getting straggly.
Yeah.
It needs cutting back a bit.
They are wonderful tree peonies. And this has probably been in here, what, 4 or 5 years?
Oh, 15, I would say.
15 years, wow. Because some of them are very vigorous and some of them are not so. But what they do is they have their wood and it will grow for about 4 or 5 years, these branches, and then they die.
Yeah.
So you have this succession of dead branches inevitably. It's nothing that you're doing, it's just the way the plant is. So when you've got this, and this plant is probably 1.2 meters high, I would say, with a spread of about 1.2.
Yeah, yeah.
And I would trace all all the ones that are totally dead. Now, this has got live wood on it.
Yeah.
So I would cut that back.
Right.
And you might find some stems are totally dead.
Right.
So I would just remove those at ground level, like that one. Oh, no, maybe it's not. So remove all the dead wood. That one there is dead. Take that back.
To take the dead out.
So you take all the dead out, and then the dead shoot bits.
Just cut above a live
bud. Exactly.
Because the buds are nice and red and very obvious. Okay.
And then you deadhead. You can deadhead just back to the new growth in the summer when it's finished flowering.
Right.
I would just deadhead those back.
Yeah.
And a lot of people with ordinary herbaceous peonies, you should not mulch them. Because they don't like it. But with tree peonies, you're fine to slap on the old mulch. And they do love sun, a bit of shade, don't they? And this one does look healthy.
No, it's a star in April. For a week, it's a bit, and then the rain comes and we curse. But, I mean, you know, the front garden here, we're finishing scraping up the leaves, and then I will mulch all this, you know, fairly heavily and just give the bulbs more protection because they're all in there.
And you've got, unusually, you've got a seat in your front garden. And do you ever sit down here? Or is it because it looks lovely?
It catches the afternoon, the late afternoon sun when it's gone off the back garden.
Yeah.
So we come out here, and in the summer, with the tree peony grown up and the salvia and things like that, we're sort of fairly invisible, so we can sit quietly here without really feeling ostentatious, you know. So, and just catch that last bit of the sun sets over there in the west, and it just filters through very nicely, and that's a nice way.
Sometimes with a
glass of rosé in our
So this garden is maybe 4.5 metres deep and going to in the corner to a bigger. But I always am sad that people don't make better use of their front gardens, because often they've got a lovely aspect. Like you, the evening sun, I think, if you're working, that is the best orientation. And they neglect them.
Yeah.
And this is so usable, so lovely, and it's such a wonderful frame to the house.
You know, every day of the year you walk through your front garden.
Every day.
In the winter you might not go over the back garden or the lawn and stuff. So we try to make it year-round fun and, you know, something happening all the time. Lifts your heart, you know, sort of, really, doesn't it?
Oh, absolutely. As you say, you see it every day of the year, and it's important, I think, is the most important space in the garden, really.
Yeah.
But I just think it must be funny if people did clock you in here, because they'd see the carson sitting next door to the late Queen Elizabeth II having a cup of tea on the bench together.
Carson Dolores Umbridge. What is going on there? That's bizarre,
And do people clock you? They must know you live here.
It's a quiet neighbourhood, and we know most of our neighbours, so it's a neighbourly chat rather than a sort of an intrusive conversation, you know. That's very nice.
Very nice. Yeah. What I think is also very clever is you've actually got your garden shed in the front garden.
That's sort of split in half because it's not wide enough for a garage. I think so. The front half is bicycles, and that's got all the canners and the dahlias overstoring for the winter in there. The back half from here is potting shed, which, I mean, let's walk
but
walk this
not
way,
many
madam.
People, I must say, would have a shed in their front garden garage. But the way, because it's on a slope, it's set down and it's painted a very knock-back green colour. Mm. And so it actually fits in beautifully, and it's in a really good position.
It fits in really well. And one of the great joys of life is being in the potting shed at low level, looking up at the garden. Different angles are good. Different viewpoints are good.
Yes.
You know, the sun coming through these grasses at this time of year is just sensational. Just lights it all up.
And then you've got Pinus mugo, is it there?
Yeah,
those lovely little pines there, and camellia in a pot.
Camellia in a pot.
Well, lovely.
I'm not the biggest fan of camellias, but
because you find them boring?
I find them, come on, you know, don't be so temperamental. And the flowers, they're a pure white for a minute, and then they get brown splodges on them, and I think, you've got to work harder than that.
Yeah,
come
they
on.
Don't die nicely, do
no,
they?
No,
they don't, I have to say. But they do have the evergreen foliage and things.
Yeah.
Yeah. It's funny, people used to think they were tender, and then someone left one out quite relatively recently and realised, my God, they're really hardy.
Yeah, no, it's got a bit of protection from the wind there, because, you know. Now, I've got to show you, I'm very proud of this, I've got to show you my leaf mould. This is Compost Corner down here.
But we're passing all your succulents in this greenhouse, and again, you've Because you're on a slope, I love the way that even the side garden to the house, which is probably 5 metres wide, is on two levels. So you've utilised the slope and you've sunk the greenhouse down, so it beds in beautifully. And I can see these wonderfully cared for succulents. Wow, they're lovely, aren't they? But I love the way you've utilised your slope. So even the side garden of the house, which is maybe 5-6 metres wide, you've put your greenhouse, set it down, and I can look at all these beautiful succulents and things you've got here, echeverias and all sorts. Immaculate condition, aren't they?
They're doing all right. I'm a big fan of the aeoniums. And there goes another plane. Can we be heard over this plane? I love Boughton House Gardens in the Cotswolds, where I first saw aeoniums in pots planted in amongst the dahlias and the cannas and stuff like that. It's so brilliant. And so I'm determined to bring all these on and plant them, drop them out in the borders.
Oh, they look wonderful like that. And they get so big, don't they? And in London, they must thrive with this extra heat.
Look at that, Bunny. Look at that. Oh, a dustbin full of leaf mould.
Very nice
isn't that
stuff,
good
isn't
stuff,
it?
Eh? Oh, I love that. I should be putting that as a mulch and improving the soil with that.
So how old is that lovely brown crumbly stuff?
That's last year.
That's
transported
good.
Into a dustbin.
And so then you just shove it in the dustbin, put the lid on and leave it?
I've got two leaf mould bins, and then all these bags are waiting for those to compress down, and then I shall add into those. And it's a whole production.
You are organised and disciplined, aren't you? You are the Carson in your method.
And then we have our little potting area in here. So.
Oh, my God. This is like Gardener's World in here. Wow. Monty Don, eat your heart
Monty
out.
Monty Don, yes.
My God, you're neater than him.
Potting area.
And you don't have full-time running staff.
No, not at all, no.
Oh, this
so
is
you, as you can see from the potting, it's a little secret world out that way. So I like just different vistas, different ways to look at the garden.
The plants are nodding in at the window, aren't they? Waving at you as you're potting up their mates.
Yeah.
Oh, it's fabulous. Yeah. You are tidier than me, for sure.
We love being in here. And then we love having to buy our bird feed by the dustbin load. that'll be gone in about 4 weeks, I would think.
Oh, they're very pleased. But what I notice is you have not got an armchair in here. You know, in most man's potting sheds, they have an armchair and a few magazines. But you're keener than that.
Absolutely.
Right. No, this is fantastic. So what got you into gardening, would you say?
Moving to this house, really. We moved here 30 years ago as our daughter was about to be born, and we inherited a very neglected and overgrown garden. We knew nothing about it, but a very good older neighbour from where we lived before came up and told us what was what, said, be patient.
But the levels, I mean, I notice your use of levels is pretty spot on.
We're lucky with,
did
with
you
having
do that. Walls?
This was just a little slope, so we terraced it and then improved it because it was yellow London clay. So 30 years of improving, and it's now very friable and you know, easy to use.
So that leaf mould that you've been banging on and the mulches, it's all
banging
your.
Banging on, Bunny, as if. You mean I've been boring you with my leaf mould? One is insulted.
No, I mean banging it on the soil.
Yeah.
But it is amazing for the mycorrhiza, the organisms. Everyone is talking about the microbiome of the soil, aren't they?
Exactly, yeah. I mean, you know, every year we mulch and we put on our own homegrown compost, which is all bagged up at the bottom waiting to go on.
Yeah.
So, you know, we improve it all the time, so we don't have to dig, you know, really. It's just good. We just dig a planting hole and bang it in.
You wouldn't want to dig, would
no.
you? Because you'd disrupt all the microorganisms and you would reduce the
we don't
fertility
need to.
Of the soil.
Why do it's backbreaking work?
Exactly,
anyway.
Exactly. You want to do the bits of gardening you enjoy and are most productive.
Yeah.
So what are your favourite bits of gardening?
Favourite bits? I mean, I don't know if I have a favourite. I mean, I love the planting. I love the planting out, really. And then we're always, you know, we're just walking past these. I can't remember the name of them. You know,
Ophiopogons, the little, dark little grasses.
Yeah. Those seed themselves around. Look, they've seeded themselves up here.
Lovely.
And so we think, okay, that works well there. Oh, no, but we'll move it over there. We'll make a little run of those along there. And just fiddling all the time and thinking, I've looked at that for 30 years and never realised that's in the wrong place. Shift it, move it, make it work, you know.
No, this is really glorious. Yeah. And then we're coming around the side and then wow, you go out and you see the back garden, yeah, yeah. And this is the big space, and it must be, what, 60 metres long? For a London garden, it's nice size, would you say?
I don't know if it's 60 metres.
Maybe 50.
Yeah, I've over-read 30 or 40, yeah, it's a bit longer than the cricket pitch, isn't it?
Oh, you're a cricketer?
Yeah.
Yes,
yeah.
Of course. And we see the cricket.
Yeah, I'm the president of the cricket club, Bunny.
Ah,
yeah, absolutely.
God, I never realised that.
Yeah, so that's the joy. So in this garden... in the summer, you hear the thwack of leather on balls, as they say. You know.
and again, the levels. So there's a sharp retaining wall at the end, so it looks like a ha-ha. It's a bit like Downton Abbey, isn't it? Yeah, it looks like you own the cricket ground, and there's no fence.
It's nothing at all like Downton Abbey, Bunny. I'm sorry to have to fall out about that, but it's
a
garden with
a borrowed space. Do they have a Highclere?
They do. As you stand on the front steps looking out, there's the lawn, and then there is a ha-ha there at the end of the lawn, but it looks like an uninterrupted view. But
well, so does yours. Don't you think you've got a bit of Downton here?
Yeah, it's a bit bigger than a ha-ha. When you get here, you see that it's... you know, it's...
Oh, my God. So you've got another garden below.
This is all... spring. This is all ferns and hellebores and leucogyms and bulbs for the spring. And then after that, we leave it to look after itself because it's kind of hard gardening on a slope like that. So we leave all that and more...
But you say you leave it, but there's nothing unwanted in there. I can't see any weeds.
Probably are. But
I can't see any.
You know, and we let all the Welsh poppies and all the self-seed in there. Here comes the 1142 to Aberystwyth. Who knew that Aberystwyth had an international airport?
They're busy today, aren't they? Yeah. They really are. And you put in these levels too.
We've rearranged them.
Yeah.
These were some odd bricks. Well, there was two pseudacacias growing here.
Whopping great jobs.
And we built
they?
A sort of a playhouse for our daughter when she was little here, with slides, down swings, things going across the tree. The trees died, which altered the light values here, so then we replanted to sort of take the light. But we didn't want... This is not high maintenance, this
no.
bit. The other borders, the herbaceous borders, are more high maintenance.
But this is such a surprise, because you get to the end and you think that's it.
But
you've got this lovely sloping garden. And then when it's your turn to take your turn at the crease, you can nip down the steps and into the thing. Is that what they...
I don't take my turn at the crease. I'm a bit old for that. My turn's sitting on the seat. You know,
right.
It's having all these viewpoints. To be able to sit in here and look back at the garden is, you know, that's our great pleasure, really.
And the water, the way you've done this. Now, we have so many people with problems with water because they see that awful black liner. But yours, I can't see your black liner at all. You've done it beautifully.
It's just disappearing, the liner. It's just about to go. It hasn't quite, but this is... We had stepping stones across to here, which was... I might have nicked that from your book, you know, the stepping stones across the pond, your family gardening book. I'm sure I saw a picture of that.
We did do that, yes.
And the stepping stones floated on the water and went across to the summer house.
Yeah.
But it sprang all sorts of leaks, so we've just redid this
a couple of years ago. I hope I got the detailing right.
I don't think... It was, it was, you know, 20 years, butyl line is going to leak. So it's bedding in still, this pond. But it's good, and we love the dragonflies. You know, we get them emerging every spring, and we love that. And the birds, of course, we've got the little area, and the birds drink at it all the time.
No, I mean, for bringing in wildlife, there is nothing better than water. But the way you've edged it is interesting, because you've got your mown lawn right up to the water.
Yeah.
So you would cut this with a strimmer.
We cut it with an ordinary. We do the edges with a strimmer. And there's an industrial brick under here with the holes in the top, so the roots go down into that.
Oh, so that gives take the weight of the mower
capsizing. You can do that without it capsizing. So it's a solid edge which the grass is slowly growing over and melding in.
Idea, actually.
Yeah, yeah.
So I remember you told me that tale at Chelsea one year, which I was so touched by, that you said when you were a daughter, is it Bessie, was very young, she was in hospital.
Oh, yeah, that's right. She's only ever had one night in hospital. And Imelda was in the theatre, so I grabbed the first book I could off the shelf and went up with her, with Bessie, and sat there from... you know, 5 o'clock till midnight when Imelda turned up and stayed the night. And the book was Bunny Guinness's Family Gardens. And you never read a gardening book from cover to cover. You always leaf through or go to the index, look for the bit you want. So I read it from cover to cover. Bessie was young, so we had all sorts of ideas from that. It was fantastic, you know, and it really inspired lots of, you know, and the garden has changed as Bessie's life has changed. It started off, she had her own little fairy garden with toy towns and tractors and things in it and animals and then the tree house and stuff. And now it's, you know, more mature, and so are we, and so is she. It's altered accordingly, you know.
That's what's lovely about gardens, that they reflect your lifestyle at different periods, and it gives you that opportunity to grow with them.
Completely. Yeah. I mean, you know, and a lot of people are saying, get rid of your lawn, but for a kid, that
Handstands, rounders,
cartwheels, and the paddling pool out there, and the sliding on the tarpaulin with the water on it, and all that. It's just a joy.
I don't quite understand this no mow business, because I think if you keep people in their gardens playing on the lawn, they're not going to be mucking up the world outside, are they?
We've tried them in the garden. A little bit of no mow, you know, but actually, we're confident enough that there's enough in the borders for the wildlife not to worry too much about it. I mean, I think it does. It can look fantastic, and I love it that sort of public parks are getting into that more and more and more. I noticed they're leaving areas of grass along, which I think looks really attractive. And you can have your cricket pitches and your football pitches, but leave the edges for the wildlife. I think that makes a lot of sense.
Yeah, it's horses for courses, and the wild look is fantastic. But it's the way that they try and tell you what to do. I find a bit irritating.
I'm not sure. I mean, you know. I think, didn't Monty Don kick off about rewilding? I think, you know, come on, there's room for it all, and it's just a different way I don't think it is prescriptive. So just leaving a strip of your lawn unmown is hardly draconian, is it, really?
Some people, if they've got a tiny lawn and they're very tidy-minded, they find it difficult.
Right.
It upsets them. So,
Do what you want, do what you want.
So when you're being the butler, do you, you know, go around deadheading your dahlias, pretending to be Carson? And do you get into the role like that, or are you much more laid? Well, how do you do it? I don't know how you do it.
I learn the lines. I get there on time. I say the lines, and I don't fall over the furniture. That's the main thing, really.
But it is, isn't it? Because you are so convincing. You know, you got this wonderful sonorous voice, and you definitely look every part of who you are being. And how do you do that?
The costume does 9/10 of it. We have a historical advisor who says, pour the wine from the right and bring in the food from the left and stand up straight and don't put your hands in your pockets. That's not too difficult to remember. Butlers are easy, because everyone's done the work before me. Anthony Hopkins in Remains of the Day and John Gielgud in Arthur, there are butlers. Jeeves, you know, there are butlers throughout English literature and entertainment, you know, film and TV. So that's easy. You know,
definitely denigrating yourself, because Carson was different to all those, and you are Carson. You know, we know, I think most people would see a butler as you.
Listeners, I've got to say that I'm standing here in my jeans with my hair blowing all over the place in a puffer jacket. I don't look anything like Carson. So the voice might sound like him.
I just imagine you with Imelda. So Imelda being the queen and wandering around, you know, with the crown on, and you being the butler, and whether you're method acting. And Bessie, your daughter, grew up with all this, and she's now an actor.
Yeah.
So was it just, she must have seen it as such a, her parents doing this really glamorous thing, and
exactly
anecdotes.
Exactly the opposite. Exactly.
Seriously?
Yeah, because she knows it's hard work and real work, you know. She, the glamour is a fool's gold. I mean, that is irrelevant. I mean, it's there sometimes, but that's got nothing to do with anything. It's a byproduct. She saw us working hard, but more importantly, she saw us enjoying ourselves and laughing all day long. I mean, being an actor gives you a license to play.
Yes.
You know, I think we're sort of reasonably playful people. She saw that and thought, you know, why wouldn't I want to do that? You know, we never told her to do it, I encouraged her to do it. She came to it of her own volition. But she has in her DNA, she's got a built-in sense of professionalism and what the work entails, yeah. rather than some people who get an idea of our business from watching a talent show on telly and want to live the dream. Well, yeah. no, live the life and dream the dream, you know, because yeah. it's nothing really, you know, it's an irrelevance.
But when you watch her in a role that she's developing or whatever, do you give her hints and tips and say, or you just let her do it her way?
Completely let her do it her way, yeah. yeah. It's, you know, I mean, we're encouraging, of course, but we know, and if she asks us questions, of course, we'll help. But no, we're just, you know, it's her life, her career. We let her do it her own way.
Yeah, yeah. Oh, yeah. It's fabulous, and I'm sure she'll be great too. But so the other thing that I always think when you're acting, you know, you're on set and it's really sort of getting it done and it's really quite frenetic, and then you have periods of when you're on set but it's actually not you there, you're waiting for the sun to go over, the weather to be right, and it's that hanging around, that's that difference between freneticness and then waiting. How do you cope with that?
Well, it's, you just accept it, really, because you can extrapolate that to our lives, you know.
I mean,
a job is kind of high octane, hard work, 14-hour days, and then
am I getting it right? You must always have that. Yeah, am I doing my
element
best?
Element of that, but you're also you get a lot of praise for what you do and a lot of support, and then you've got to cope with the next 3 months out of work. That's where you've got to get the balance. So you, daily on a set, you've got to get the balance right. I'm needed for this scene. I've got to have my energy there. I can't dissipate my energy by sort of farting about too much, really.
Yeah.
So you stay focused because you're being paid to work. And then, you know, in your life, you've got to have something else in your life. Like gardening is for us. It's a big release. It's a way to switch off. You can't go from the highs to the lows. You've got to find a way to, you know, find the balance in everything. And it's, you learn how to do it. It's part of the game.
Yeah, but that is two very good things that work together, isn't it? Gardening and acting, I would think.
I think so, yeah. Mm. I mean, I think because we do get time off, so you've got to fill that time creatively, and gardening is kind of creative, you know, and it's physical exercise without having to go into a gym.
Yeah, yeah. Know. No, it's wonderful, I think. So there are many of your colleagues. Are they into it? Do they see you come in with your bunches of Astas or whatever to decorate your Winnebago on
set?
They
get bored with me talking about cricket and gardening, I must admit. But
there's
a gang of us, some of the downstairs staff mainly. I go around and help them with their gardens because they've either moved into new places or they've never done anything with their garden. So I go around as a one-man ground force and help buy and design and make things and help them and encourage them into gardening, and they're picking up on it. And Mrs. Patmore, the cook, has got quite green fingers, and she's just found that out. And so that's a delight.
And has she got her own style in the garden, or have you done your approach?
She's got a small, beautiful courtyard garden, which was a little bit higgledy-piggledy, so I've just brought a little bit of sort of order to that and make sure it's green and welcoming at all times of the year. And, you know, just getting people started is a pleasure, because gardeners are generous. When we came here, this was a blank canvas. Well, it was overgrown canvas. It was a mess. You know, as I say, our old neighbour came over and gave us encouragement. And gardeners are generous with their time and their ideas and stuff like that. And it's nice to be able to, you know, hopefully pass on a little bit of the stuff I've picked up.
Oh, that's really, really nice.
Mm. As I look around the garden, I realise, Bunny, that everything we can see here, we've planted, apart from this old pear tree, which must, I think, be 70 years old at least, I would think. And the centre is completely hollow and dead, and I think it's on its way out. I mean, can we grow things up that? Can we grow a sort of a climbing rose or a clematis up there to keep the shape of it?
It's interesting, isn't it? Because they always say you plant pears for your heirs, because they take time to develop into those wonderful trees. And it is I always think old pear trees are one of a fantastic
it's
asset.
It's beautiful.
They have such
yeah.
character.
Yeah.
And I was recently talking to a lot of people who are experts in these old trees. And we used to think in the olden days that you'd have a stem, dead stem like that trunk, where you've got that dead bit in the middle, cut it out, get rid of the disease because it's going to spread. But the whole thinking has changed, because in that dead bit of wood there, you've got hollows, you've got all sorts of beetles and things that you won't have anywhere else.
We get the woodpecker on there a lot.
Woodpeckers, yeah. And that is a fantastic for nesting birds, far better than any bird box, you can put up. And there's actually a lot of value in all that dead wood. So I would definitely hang on and keep it as long as you can. I mean, if it's growing near a building and it's going to hit someone, then it's a problem. But there it's not.
If we grew something up, would that put too much weight on it if it's dying?
What did happen on a job in Japan, there was a typhoon and all the trees with the ivies keeled over because of the typhoon, because of the extra wind resistance. So that's the only thing you need to watch. But apart from that ivy, because at Burley Park they had lots of oaks with ivy and they removed the ivy and actually the oak suffered.
Right.
So that ivy that's up at the moment is probably actually changing the microclimate around the trunk and is probably doing it a lot of benefit. Okay. So add a clematis, add what you like, as long as you don't put something really heavy.
Sure, well we keep the ivy trimmed to that level so it doesn't put too much bulk into it.
So that is lovely in itself, isn't it? Do you think you might put? Which clematis were you thinking of? A rose, or with the rose up there?
Maybe a rose. Does a generous gardener grow up? Would that grow up there?
Up that high, I don't think.
What would be a good
one? A mutabilis, you see, I think is a lovely rose. I do wonder, though, with your pet, because it's still alive in places.
Yeah.
Talking about your leaf mold, your mulch, they do say that, and again in Burley Park, they put a wood chip or mulch, a good 50 mil layer around the base, and all the oak trees that were suffering from the oak trees get, because of all the compaction at Burley, when they put the mulch around, it was like a Persil advert. The ones with the mulch look really green and healthy, and the ones without it look sick. And they brought it right out to the edge of the canopy, but they didn't shove it up against the trunk base.
Right.
So I would, you've got the pebbles there, which is sort of, but I would try and put lots of your lovely mulch, and I think you might see it. It might help it on.
Perfect.
But it's wonderful to have something like that. And it's such a privilege, isn't it? And people have enjoyed it for maybe 100 years. No, it's
brilliant.
Fabulous.
Okay, good tip.
I always like to bring my guests on this a plant or something. So I knew you're a gardener, so I'll try and bring you something that you haven't got. I hope you haven't. But this is Salvia involucrata hadspun.
Carter.
Involucrata. Involucrata.
Wow. Hadspun.
So it's a tall salvia that grows up to about the size, almost the height of you, I would say. And it's hardy, or definitely be hardy in London, because you are so much warmer than much of the country. And I think it's a gem because it's tiny. It's a cutting that I took maybe a couple of months ago. But in one season, mine grew from that to way bigger than you with light, airy branches.
Oh.
And it has these beautiful sort of magenta flowers that it produces profusely. And it's very easy from cutting. So I'm sure you'll soon have 10 of those.
So
shall I
put that in the cold frame till the
spring? I would do. I would, because it is hardy, particularly here. It's hardy with me in Cambridgeshire. But because it hasn't got its roots down, and then next sort
that's
of May.
Fantastic.
They are, I think they're wonderful
plants.
So that's
plant. Hadspun House then,
which is
now the
Penny
Newt.
Hop House. Now the Newt.
Well, which is a favourite garden of ours.
Now, I was told by a little bird that you talked to the head gardener's conference at the Newt. Tell me all about that.
Yeah, we did. Well, we're patrons of a wonderful charity called Green Fingers, which makes beautiful gardens for children's hospices, designed that the children who've got a life limiting condition can be pushed out in their beds or wheelchairs and work at raised beds. The brothers and sisters can rampage around. Mum and dad have got a place of reflection. I was asked to do a speech at the all-party parliamentary gardening group on the terrace at the House of Commons, and there were about 50 MPs, and the horticultural trade was there, the horticultural press. So I spoke on an idea that sort of coalesced in my mind as a result of lockdown, which is the need for young people to get outside. Lockdown, young people got trapped inside, Zoom calls, schooling from home, spending too much time on the screen. So we heard this phrase, less screen time, more green time, get kids outside, get schools to provide outside space for gardening, get it on the curriculum, it's healthy, it teaches so much, it expands into other areas of the curriculum. We went to a primary school recently that's got a garden. The year sixes were doing a history project on the First World War. So in the garden, they were doing Dig for Victory. So it's kind of linked up together. Mm. So, and as a result of this, talking at Parliament, appearing in the press, we were asked to open the Head Gardeners Conference at the Newt in Somerset, which we were a little bit nervous about, you know, but we thought, hey, we're keen, you know, we're enthusiastic, so are they. As you say, gardeners are generous. And we were down there for 2 days of symposiums and talks and demonstrations, and everybody's talking about the same thing: more sustainability. You be aware of the climate change, cope with that, don't contribute to it, make it more diverse, make it more, make horticulture and gardening more open to everyone, so everybody can feel, you know, the psychic and physical benefits. Mm. You know, it takes a strain off the NHS if people are healthy, you know, and outside, breathing the air, growing their own food.
And we have got more gardens per capita in this country than many, haven't we?
We're so lucky, I think, is we've also got four seasons. So that keeps gardening interesting. Yeah. I mean, if you were gardening in LA, you'd just grow the same plants every year and tidy them up, you know.
Or in Sweden, just in the summer, and you can't really do it in the winter.
So, I mean, even in the winter now, you know, we can look around and the grasses are all looking great and blowing in the wind, and the roses are still going.
So how are you going to get this on the curriculum? Because I think that would be so good.
Well, you'd need a change of heart from the government. Instead of doing things from the top down, do it from the bottom up. I mean, engage the teachers in it, engage armies of volunteers who would happily come in and help, you know. Oh, we haven't the expertise. In ask for help and get people into the schools, release grounds, you know, Hounslow are releasing 27 acres of council land for schools to use for allotments and orchards and outside space. Rethink the curriculum. Is the curriculum fit for purpose? You know, is it fit for the modern day? And is it fit for the fact that children aren't going back to school? Now children see, and parents see, school as an option. So the way to get around that is it's not compulsory. They see it as an option. Put joy into the curriculum. Yeah. Get them keen to go back to see how their sunflower seeds are growing, or if their carrots have developed and stuff like that. You know, and make it something that they can pass on into their adult life.
I mean, I always think that when you have children outside, they're so much easier to deal with. And when my kids, if they'd fall over and cut themselves, and they'd scream inside, and then if you picked them up and took them outside, they would usually, unless they're seriously injured, they would stop crying. Yeah. The outside sounds, it's more relaxing, the fresh air, it's calming. And with all these discipline and drug problems, I think if you could get kids outside more, I'm sure they would be easier.
I've got a friend who's a psychologist, works with children. She said, and they'll come in and they'll, if you look at them across a desk, they're mute. You go outside, you sit side by side, you look around, you say, oh, that's a robin. Oh, look at those pigeons there. A little conversation starts that grows. Mm. It's being outside, just taking in the natural world, and you feel it by osmosis coming up through your feet. And I think it's a perfectly valid, you know, activity at my age, just to sit for 20 minutes in the garden and just absorb it. And then you start to hear, you pick out the bird sounds, and you think, oh, that bit needs doing there. And you know,
and you leave your phone in your pocket and you don't check it out and check the latest emails.
Don't do any of that.
But I have to say, with the thing that instigated that book, the Family Gardens book that I wrote, was because when the children were 2 and 3 or something, we had a children's party. We engaged a clown outside in the garden. And he was brilliant. I'd seen him at another party. He was really entertaining. But all these kids ignored Oodley Doodley, the Fenland clown, and they were in the wild pond.
Of course.
And playing in the bushes. And, you know, I just thought, well, actually, that is the draw. It's the natural water, the newts. I mean, some poor child had brand new start right shoes, and his mother nearly killed him when she picked him up because he'd been in the water with them. But that's what they love.
Exactly. But, if you're on the 15th floor of a tower block, you don't have access to that. So make access to it. Sort of take a corner of Regent's Park and make it available. Take, you know, council ground or roundabouts or stations or any bit of spare ground, make it available for schools and children to get outside and have all, you know, I'm aware of how, you know, incredibly privileged we are to have this, you know, and we were deeply aware in lockdown that, God, the weather's marvellous and there's no planes in the sky, unlike today. God, it's silent. How wonderful is that?
Yeah.
And thought, this is not available to everyone, and it should be, I think, and it could be.
I mean, there's a town, is it in Holland or Germany, called Andernach, and every roundabout verge, everything is planted with edible veg. Wow. And the people work on it as well. You know, no berberis and cotoni asters and things. It's all edible, productive, shared, people use it. And I think that sort of approach, because we have a lot of bits of green that we could
completely.
Do far more with.
Yeah, I mean, I'm going to, you know, the cricket pitch behind me, I'm going to try and, you know, plant up the edges much more, you know, wildlife friendly. There's a wonderful hedge over there with lots of hawthorn and elder and all sorts of good things in it. You know, encourage all that, every square inch. You know.
Yeah. Oh, I hope you get lots of support, because I think it would be amazing. And in other countries like Germany, horticultural students are taken seriously. It's a serious occupation. They're well paid. Whereas in the UK, I'm afraid it is still very much the autobahn trade. And if you say you're doing horticulture, people look at you a bit sniffily. And I just think if we, I mean, whereas your profession is the polar opposite. Everyone wants to be, you know, an actor, glitzy showbiz. How can we, with your actor's head on, how can we make horticulture more glitzy, more?
Well,
do you think that would ruin it?
No, not in the slightest. I mean, I think you need to make it very available to people and very accessible. I mean, you know, I watch gardening programs on the TV, get younger people presenting them, sort of thing, get out to where the young people are, get them involved. I love those things on TV programs where they go to schools or community allotments and you see young people just enjoying themselves in the garden. One thing we learnt at the Head Gardeners Conference, there was an organization, I think it was English Heritage, said that they can't get different ethnic groups and younger people into their gardens. So the chap walked past a mosque and saw a very neglected garden there, and he asked him, can I take my volunteers in there? The volunteers went in, helped with the garden, started a conversation with the women, the men started to drift towards them, they started to talk about what they grew at home, and a whole relationship grew that then they trusted, you know, the gardening group and would go to their gardens as well. It's a question of building up trust where people live, you know, rather than expecting them to come to you, you go to them, make that effort.
So it was very much from the grassroots, and then people see it. That's a very clever idea. Because it just grabs you, doesn't it? You start with horticulture and then it really sort of takes over you and you become passionate about it.
Yeah.
But it's that step in getting people to realise.
It is that step, you know.
Yeah.
You know,
well, I think it's fantastic what you're doing. I really do.
We love it, Bunny. You know, we're very happy.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And, well, I'm certainly impressed with your garden. I love it.
Oh.
And you will never move from here, will you?
That's it. No, we will never move. There's room for a chairlift up the stairs, so we'll be fine, you know. We'll be happy.
I'm seeing all the birds around your bird feeder because we hear all these London sounds, but I can imagine, because of your water and your bird feeder, that the actual noise of the birds will drown out many of the sounds. They're the best noise foils.
This is, you've got a particularly noisy day. Yeah, we got a parakeet just landed on next door's pear tree. Now, the other day I counted 33 parakeets in the garden.
Good or bad? Do you like them or hate them?
Well, I'm not fond of them, but I noticed that the other main bird we get are goldfinches, which I love. You know, you can't believe it. I mean, it's such an exotic bird. But they're learning to live with them. They're learning to fight their way in onto the feeders. We've got four feeders up there. They're learning to fight their way in amongst the parakeets. So I think these things balance out and nature will find a way to balance it out. I mean, I don't. The noise of the parakeet, it's alien, isn't it? You know, it's from where? India, or not from here. But we'll get used to it.
Yeah, we have red kites with us. The sky is black with red kites.
In lockdown, they came in.
Did
this
they?
Yeah, they came in looking for roadkill in
oh,
you know,
wow.
And then last year, I saw, we've had 37 different species of bird in the garden, and I saw a red-legged partridge in our...
Oh, we have those.
What
was
that doing in a London garden? You know?
Yeah, wow, that is extraordinary, isn't it?
Yeah.
But I'm sure these gardens in London are actually a lot richer than a lot of the arable countryside around us, which is acres of wheat nothing much else but pigeons. And
well, the
stuff.
Domestic gardens, you know, we can form a little corridor for the
Absolutely.
Wildlife, you know, sort of, and if you've got water and food, in shelter.
Yeah.
You know, we've got a little wren's nest in our summer house there, so we were afraid to go in while it was nesting in the summer house.
Oh.
And, you know, so, yeah, very good. We love it.
It's a delight. Well, thank you very much. It's been fascinating to chat with you.
I hope I didn't gabble too much.
Oh, you couldn't, Carson. You could not gabble with that wonderful voice. Okay, thank you.
Well, that's a treat, Bonnie. Thank you.